if you are new or just joining us this semester or first time ever, this semester, the spring semester, we're going through looking at the life of David. And the Bible says in a couple places that David was a man after God's own heart. And we've talked about that some, and we have talked about David being a giant killer. Probably many of you are familiar with that story, even if you haven't been here for that, weren't here for that. David as a fugitive, David as a leader. And today, we're going to look at specifically a relationship David had with one individual person. This person, his name is difficult to say, and so I have to say it a lot today. So I'm going to make you say it with me a couple of times here at the front end because it's hard to say. This person that I want to look at his relationship with David is Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth. Okay, I'm going to say it one more time, and then you're going to say it with me so you can hear it one more time slowly. Mephibosheth. Okay. Now, oh, good. Thank you. Yeah. You're all going to try together now as I count to three, and we're going to say it together. One, two, three. Mephibosheth. Yeah, it's hard, right? Okay, one more time. One, two, three. Mephibosheth. Okay. I'm going to say it wrong a couple times, and I'm just going to move right on past. So you know who I'm talking about if my mouth gets kind of garbled up, okay? Mephibosheth. If you don't know who Mephibosheth is, I'm going to tell you. Mephibosheth was the son of Jonathan, who also, Jonathan was the son of Saul. Saul was the king of Israel, the first king of Israel, right before David became king of Israel. Jonathan was Saul's son, and Mephibosheth was Saul's grandson. So in 2 Samuel 4, we read about Mephibosheth for the first time. You don't need to turn there. It's just one verse. I'll read it to you. It's fairly short. But we get a glimpse of who Mephibosheth was. Jonathan, this is 2 Samuel 4, if you want to know. 2 Samuel 4, verse 4. Jonathan, the son of Saul, had a son who was crippled in his feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel, and his nurse took him up and fled. And as she fled in her haste, he fell and became lame. And his name was Mephibosheth. So this is like a heartbreaking story, right? At the age of five, Mephibosheth loses his grandpa, loses his dad, and his ability to walk normally all in one day. So Saul and Jonathan are killed in battle, and the word gets back to the nurse taking care of Mephibosheth, and so she flees. Why does she flee? Well, it's important for you to understand that back then, in the Old Testament times in particular, when a new king came into power, traditionally, the new king would make sure that no one from the old king's family or king's like closest advisors, people that were loyal to the old king, were still around. And so they didn't like just ask them to leave. They had them killed. All of them were killed, typically. That was kind of the way things worked. So if a new king came into power, part of his job when he first started was to go ahead and wipe out anyone else that was left over from the old kingship, whether that be family members or advisors, close friends, people that were loyal to the old king. So the nurse knows this is a problem, and so she flees with Mephibosheth. And so we're going to find out in a minute where they went, but just a little spoiler. They leave, they go away, and they hide. Because quite literally, Mephibosheth is now an enemy of the king. At least from the kind of the worldly perspective at the time, he has, with Saul dying and David being in line to come into kingship next, he's automatically becomes an enemy of the king. So they have to hide. So they fear for their life. So they go and they hide. This is, he's 5 years old. So from 5 years old until we're not sure exactly when, we'll talk about in a minute, but he goes and lives in hiding for fear of his life because he can't be, because he's an enemy of the king. So that's at least a little bit on Mephibosheth. We'll talk about him more in a second. Something else you need to know about before we get into our scripture for today is Jonathan's relationship with David. And Jonathan is Mephibosheth's dad, and Jonathan and David were friends. They were good friends. And Saul, who is Jonathan's dad, didn't like the fact that Jonathan and David were friends. But Jonathan didn't care that his dad didn't like that they were friends. And so Jonathan worked really hard to protect David, because Saul quite often was seeking to find ways to get rid of David. And so in 1 Samuel 20 is another one of these instances where David is trying to get away from Saul and stay safe, and Jonathan is very actively helping to protect him. So he kind of goes in and gets a feel, is Saul angry today? Is Saul not angry today? And then he gets the word back to David. And so they're having this conversation, and in 1 Samuel 20, verse 13 says, "But if my father intends to harm you," this is Jonathan talking, "may the Lord deal with Jonathan, be it ever so severely, if I do not let you know and send you away in peace. May the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. But show me unfailing kindness, like the Lord's kindness, as long as I live, so that I may not be killed. And do not ever cut off your kindness from my family, not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth." So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "May the Lord call David's enemies to account." And Jonathan had David reaffirm his oath out of love for him, because he loved him as he loved himself. So basically, if you didn't follow that, David promises that he will not harm anyone in Jonathan's family, even though, because Jonathan knows it's customary for the new king to kill everyone in the old king's family, Jonathan asks David to make this promise. And David makes the promise. He also makes the promise to Saul. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about David as a fugitive. He was running away from Saul. At one point, David comes across Saul. He's in a cave, relieving himself. Saul is in the cave, relieving himself, and David sneaks up behind him. He could have killed him, but he doesn't. He just cuts off a piece of his cloak, his coat. Saul comes out, and David comes out and says, "Ha-ha, look, I could have killed you. I didn't." He didn't have an attitude like that. Sorry, I would have an attitude like that. David was better than me. I didn't kill you. I could have, because you are God's anointed, and you know, I don't want to get in your way. And so Saul, realizing that he almost died, says in 1 Samuel 24, "And now behold, I know that you shall surely be king." This is Saul talking to David. "And that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand. Swear to me, therefore, by the Lord, that you will not cut off my offspring after me, and that you will not destroy my name out of my father's house." David swore this to Saul. Then Saul went home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold. So he makes a similar promise to Saul about his family. Saul didn't know he already made the promise to Jonathan, so probably it was a little easier for David to make this promise to Saul, because he's like, well, it's the same promise. But Jonathan actually asks for more than Saul does, which we'll get to in a minute. But Saul just says, don't kill off all my offspring and destroy and totally wipe out my name. Jonathan asks for David to show his family loving kindness. So there's a little bit different there, but basically the same promise, okay? So David makes this promise with Saul's family and with Jonathan's family, who again are the same family. And so he makes this promise with them, and then Saul and Jonathan are killed. They're killed in battle, and David becomes king over Israel. There's a lot of things that happen before he becomes king over all of Israel, but we won't get into that today. Then David goes and conquers. There's lots of battles and fighting, and he conquers a bunch of people and lands and expands the kingdom. And then we see in 2 Samuel 8, if you want to turn there, this is where we'll be today, is in 2 Samuel 8 and 9. 2 Samuel 8, there's one verse specifically that shows us David's kind of attitude and overall kind of view of leadership, which is kind of a continuation from last week. But it says, 2 Samuel 8, "So David reigned over all of Israel." This is in chapter 8, there's a bunch of lists of all of these battles that David just got finished doing. It said, "He reigned over all of Israel, and David administered justice and equity to all his people." The message says he ruled well, that he fair and even-handed in all his duties and relationships. So that leads right into our story for today. We're going to be in 2 Samuel 9. We're going to go through all of chapter 9 of 2 Samuel. Verse 1 says this, David said, "Is there still anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" So David's got done with all this fighting, and he's reflecting and remembering this promise that he made to Jonathan. Now, this promise was probably 15 plus years ago now, at this point, that he made with Jonathan. No one else was around when he made this promise with Jonathan. There were some people around, I think, when he made the promise to Saul. But no one was around with Jonathan. So the only other person who knows is dead. And he's the king of Israel. He's kind of shown he's like kind of a big deal. And so he could probably do whatever he wants, and no one would know, be the wiser. He promised Saul the same thing, but he's especially motivated, we see here in this first verse, to uphold the covenant. He's motivated to uphold the covenant for John's sake, because for the love of his friend, right? He says, is there anyone left in the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake? And the word kindness there is used in verse 3 and 7 also. And it's also the same word that's used in the covenant that he makes with Jonathan back in 1 Samuel 20, which we just read. And the Hebrew word is chesed. This is another word that you're going to get to pronounce with me today, because I don't want to be the only one saying it. So the Hebrew word is chesed, all right? Can you all say it with me on the count of three? One, two, three. Chesed. If you had milk this morning, probably a little more helpful. You've got a little more phlegm built up there. One more time. One, two, three. Chesed. It's good. There's no single word in our language that adequately translates the Hebrew word chesed. When it's used in the Old Testament, it's translated, it's used in the Old Testament a lot, and it's translated into various English words, from kindness to loving kindness to mercy to goodness. It's this combination of affection and desire and intimacy, love, along with a stability, a dependability, an unswerving commitment, and a steady reliability. So basically, a steadfast love, some versions say. It's a loyal love. It's a faithful love. It's a covenantal love. It's a devoted love promised within a covenant. And this word is often used in the Bible to describe God's love for us, chesed. So David goes out of his way. He makes a very special effort to find this, any, to see if there are any enemies, because really, according to the world, anyone in Saul's family would be his enemy. If there's any of his enemies out there that he can love, that he can show chesed to. So, again, he says, is there still anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake? Verse 2 says, now there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba, and they called him to David. And the king said to him, are you Ziba? And he said, I am your servant. And he doesn't really answer the question, but I guess we're going to assume that's Ziba. And the king said, is there not still someone of the house of Saul that I may show the kindness of God to him? Again, that's the same word, chesed. Ziba said to the king, there is still a son of Jonathan. He is crippled in his feet. The king said to him, where is he? And Ziba said to the king, he is in the house of Machir, the son of Ammiel, at Lo Debar. So Ziba does say, yes, answers David's question, yes, there is someone. But he's crippled. So, you know, kind of implying probably don't even want him around. Doesn't even tell David what his name is. And David isn't like, oh, he's crippled, really? Like, how crippled? Like, can't walk? Or, no, David doesn't ask that. He says, he just wants to know, okay, where is he? Where is he? Jonathan's son, Ziba says, is in Lo Debar, which literally means no pasture in Hebrew. So he's in this desolate, barren place. Because remember, he's hiding. He is hiding. He's trying to stay away, far away from the king, his new supposed enemy. So then King David, verse 5, sent and brought him from the house of Machir, the son of Ammiel, at Lo Debar. If you can imagine Mephibosheth's surprise when some of David's men show up in the middle of nowhere to get him. He knows this can mean only one thing. He's going to be killed, right? He's been trying to do his best to stay as far away from possible as possibly can, and but David has found him, and he's asking him to come see the king. So his response in verse 6 is not surprising. Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, is the first time they say his word, his name, in this passage. And Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David and fell on his face and paid homage. He fell on his face. He honored his king and could have added probably, please don't kill me, to that. And David said, "Mephibosheth." And he answered, "Behold, I am your servant." And David said to him, "Do not fear, for I will show you kindness for the sake of your father, Jonathan." Again, that's the word chesed. "And I will restore to you all the land of Saul, your father, and you shall eat at my table always." And he paid homage and said, "What is your servant that you should show regard for a dead dog such as I?" So Mephibosheth is totally, totally caught off guard. It's absolutely the last thing that Mephibosheth was expecting from his enemy, who would have had every reason and every right, again, in the world's eyes to kill him. But instead, he receives chesed from David. And it's interesting in this passage in 2 Samuel 9, when David's talking to Ziba, it just refers to David as king. When David is talking to Mephibosheth, it refers to it calls him David. And I don't know, that might just be a very subtle thing and not important, but it seems to me that it shows a little personal touch that David had with Mephibosheth. So then, verse 9, the king called Ziba, Saul's servant, and said to him, "All that belonged to Saul and to all his house I have given to your master's grandson. And you and your sons and your servants shall till the land for him and shall bring him the produce that your master's grandson may have bread to eat. But Mephibosheth, your master's grandson, shall always eat at my table." Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. So David's basically saying, "You're going to take care of Mephibosheth and all anything that he needs." And then Ziba said to the king, "According to all that my lord the king commands his servant, so your servant will do." So Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. And Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah, and all who lived in Ziba's house became Mephibosheth's servants. So Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he ate always at the king's table. Now he was lame in both his feet. Again, they have to like reiterate the fact that he is crippled at the end of the passage. Can't get a break. Charles Swindoll has a book about David. It's actually a book. I think it's a book of his sermons that he used to preach on David. And he said this story is the best illustration of grace in the Old Testament. David is very much a grace giver. Grace, at least Swindoll's definition of grace, says it's unmerited favor. Extending special favor to someone who doesn't deserve it, who hasn't earned it, and can never repay it. That's grace. Grace is positive and unconditional acceptance in spite of the other person. David very much showed grace to Mephibosheth. He didn't deserve it, he didn't earn it, and he could never repay David. He really should have been David's enemy. In spite of that, David brings him into his house and makes him part of his family. Eugene Peterson also has a book on David, his life, and he says, "Grace isn't picky. Grace doesn't look for things that have been done that deserve love. Grace operates apart from the response or the ability of the individual. Grace is very much is one-sided." David very much shows Mephibosheth grace. And in the grace that he shows them, he gives them three things. And this is, I took this from one of the commentaries at the moment. I can't remember which one it was. It's three P's, though, so that's fun for those of you that grew up in church and always have to have alliteration and 3 points, okay? Protection, provision, and position. David, in his grace that he showed Mephibosheth, he gave him protection, provision, and position. He gave him protection. He should have, again, by all accounts, been killed. But he didn't, and he protected him, and he brought him in to Jerusalem, gave him and let him be in the house with him, protected him. He had the king's protection. Provision. He gave him all of Saul's stuff. Everything that was Saul's is now Mephibosheth's. And he gave him a position. He always eats at the king's table. It's mentioned 4 times in these 13 verses that he gets to eat at the king's table. So there's emphasis there. And verse 11 specifically says, "You get to eat at the king's table like one of the king's sons." He is family. He was living out in the middle of nowhere with nothing. hiding from this guy who he thought was going to kill him, has now brought him in to have everything he needs and to be one of the family. One of the commentaries said David heaps goodness on Mephibosheth. He not only protects his life, but restores his inheritance. He not only saves him from the shadow of death, but prepares a table for him. David's kindness goes beyond survival to sustenance. Mephibosheth is cared for by and with the king and will never face destitution. Does that sound familiar? I hope that it does. Romans 5 says this: "You see, just at just the right time, when we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. Very rarely will anyone die for a righteous person, though for a good person someone might possibly dare to die. But God demonstrates his own love for us in this: while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Since we have now been justified by his blood, how much more shall we be saved from God's wrath through him? For if, while we were God's enemies, we were reconciled to him through the death of his son, how much more, having been reconciled, shall we be saved through his life?" This passage reminds us of what our former status was before Jesus came into our lives. The same as Mephibosheth: powerless, ungodly, sinners, and enemies of God, our King. Jesus changed all of that for us. And he didn't just save us from death, because that would be good. David didn't just save Mephibosheth from death. He just didn't stop there. Okay, I won't kill you, but stay living out there in the middle of nowhere and struggling to, you know, find some things to eat. He brings him into the family. John 1:16 says, "From his fullness we've all received grace upon grace." When we come into the family of God, from Jesus' fullness, we have received grace upon grace. John 6 says, Jesus said to them, "I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me shall not hunger, and whoever believes in me shall never thirst." We have everything that we need. Romans 8. "What shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also with him graciously give us all things?" He has graciously given us all that we need. David is a covenant-keeping king. David went out of his way to keep his promise of showing chesed to Saul and to Jonathan's family. God similarly is a covenant-keeping king. He has gone out of his way to show us his chesed through his son Jesus. Even though we are powerless, even though we were ungodly, even though we were sinners and we were his enemy, at the time that he goes out of his way to show us his chesed, he still does it. And there's nothing that we can give back to earn the protection and the provision and the position that God offers us. God is always ready and willing to keep his covenant with us, regardless of who we are or what we've done or how we've treated him or anyone else. Because he's promised us that. Lewis Meads is an author, and I read an article by him this week about promises, and it's actually a great article about the power of a promise, and he connects it to forgiveness and the promises actually being like the second most godly thing you can do next to forgiving someone. And it's a great article, but he has this line he says about a promise. He described a promise this way: "A promise is a small sanctuary of trust within the jungle of unpredictability." A promise is a small sanctuary of trust within the jungle of unpredictability. We have this sanctuary of trust with and through Jesus. We have life under the covenant, this new covenant that Jesus initiated when he came. And that should evoke in us a sense of security and privilege and wonder and awe, like we talked about at the beginning. because we are all Mephibosheth. Jesus didn't come because we, you know, things were kind of bad and, you know, they could probably use some help. We were destined for destruction. Romans says the wages of sin is death. What God told Adam and Eve from the beginning is true. If you eat of this tree, of the knowledge of good or evil, you will surely die. They didn't die right away. The serpent was kind of right when he lied to them, but they died. And that death is not only death, but separation from God. It's bad. And I think that a lot of us, especially those of us that maybe have grown up in the faith and been around church for a while, forget how bad it is. Without Jesus, we are God's enemy. The wages of sin is death. Thankfully, while we were still sinners, while we were still ungodly, while we were powerless, Christ came to die for us. We are Mephibosheth to God. We should not be eating at the king's table, but he has gone out of his way to come and find us in the middle of nowhere and bring us back so we can sit at the table with him as his son or as his daughter. We've been adopted into his family. And that is good news. And unfortunately, that is news sometimes that doesn't always feel like good news. We were on a retreat with some guys this weekend, and we talked about the importance of remembering. As believers, we have to remember. And it's important that we remember what God has done for us, because it's easy for us to kind of go along in life and forget what life would be like without Jesus. We're a dead dog without Jesus. I think grace sometimes doesn't have the powerful taste. We can't always taste it. I have a good friend and mentor who said that grace is something that you really can only get in your gut. And we can understand it with our head. And I can explain it to you, but it is something that we only can only get in our gut. And we don't always have that sense of how different life would be without Jesus. We aren't in awe of what Jesus has done as much as we should be. Grace, David's grace, very much had an effect on Mephibosheth. We read in 2 Samuel 16, David has to leave Jerusalem because people are trying to take his kingdom, and he's got to go because it's dangerous for him. So he leaves, and Ziba, who is, remember, Mephibosheth's servant, meets David as he's fleeing, and he brings all this stuff to David, and David says, what's all this stuff for? Oh, it's for you, you know, it's for your men, and as you go, and David said, where's Mephibosheth? And Ziba says, well, he didn't come, basically, and he's staying back in the city hoping to take the throne that should be rightfully his. And so David said, okay, well, you can have all the stuff then, all Saul's stuff. Go ahead. You can have all that stuff. Things work out. Long story. We don't get into that. David comes back to Jerusalem, and Mephibosheth, still in Jerusalem, comes out to meet David as he's coming back to the city. And this is 2 Samuel 19. I have this on the slide. Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king, and he had neither taken care of his feet, nor trimmed his beard, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he came back in safety. And when he came to Jerusalem to meet the king said to him, why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth? He answered, my lord, O king, my servant deceived me. my servant Ziba deceived me. For your servant said to him, for I said to him, I will saddle a donkey for myself, that I may ride on and go with the king. For your servant is lame. Ziba, he has slandered your servant to my lord the king. Ziba lied about what I did. I wanted to come with you, David. But my lord the king is like the angel of God. Do therefore what seems good to you. For all my father's house were but men doomed to death. He is still aware of his situation. We were doomed to death before my lord the king. But you set your servant among those who eat at your table. What further right have I then to cry to the king? And the king said to him, why speak any more of your affairs? I have decided you and Ziba shall divide the land. Again, David being graceful here in this situation. And Mephibosheth said to the king, oh, let them take it all, since my lord the king has come home safely. We see how David's grace has affected him. He doesn't care about the stuff. He doesn't even want the stuff. He just wants David. Again, in those verses, he is still very aware of his need. The fact that he would have been dead without David's loving kindness, without David's chesed. It's so easy for us, if we're a believer, I think it's so easy for us to forget where we would be without Jesus. That we'd be out in the middle of nowhere, helpless and afraid and alone. If you're not a believer, maybe you come in here today, this morning, and you feel crippled or helpless or are separated from a fuller life than you've had so far. Maybe you're hiding from God. Maybe you're running from God. You don't have to. He has not forgotten about you. He's actually looking for you. And if you're here today, I think he's very actively looking for you. So you can come sit at his table as one of his sons or daughters. One thing that we do here every Sunday is take communion. So if you're passing that, you can go get that ready. And the reason that we do that is because, like I said earlier, it's so important for us to remember. And we have to remind each other. And so we get together once a week and we remind each other of this thing that Jesus has done. And in communion, we remember what Jesus did on the cross for us. The night before Jesus was crucified, he had dinner with his disciples, his closest 12, the closest 12 people he had in his life when he was here on earth. And he had bread, they had bread and wine, and he broke the bread and he told them to take this and remember me and this new covenant that I am initiating today, this weekend. And the same with the cup. He took the wine and he passed it out and he said, take this and remember me and this new covenant, this new promise that I've made to you today.